Good afternoon. Today I am very pleased and honored to be introducing this year's convocation speaker, Professor Ian Gentles. Professor Gentles has been a greatly valued member of the Department of History at the University College for the past 10 years. Before that time, and in part concurrent with it, he also had a long and fruitful career at Glendon College, part of York University. Indeed, Ian has been an outstanding historian of 17th century England, especially the period of the English Revolution, since not long after earning his PhD at the University of London, almost 50 years ago. But in joining Tyndale a decade ago, Ian brought with him many gifts, not the least of which were wisdom, experience, and a certain winsomeness. He has been a truly outstanding colleague and friend, a patient and thorough teacher, and an exemplary scholar and Christian public intellectual. It was for these and other reasons, therefore, that just recently Tyndale bestowed upon him the well-deserved title of Distinguished Professor Emeritus. Some years ago, a biography of Oliver Cromwell came out. Not Ian's biography, a different one. Not as good as Ian's, by the way, but I won't say anything more. But it had a very good subtitle. The subtitle was Our Chief of Men. I would like to suggest that in many ways, such is what Ian has been to his faculty colleagues at Tyndale since he joined us in 2006. So to that end, it gives me great pleasure to present to you the 2016 University College Convocation Speaker, Professor Ian Gentles.
Thank you, Brad, for that generous introduction. Mr. President, members of the Board of Governors, happy graduands and faculty colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. My title, as you can see, is What Does History Matter in a Christian Liberal Arts College? Why indeed, you might ask, judging by the low enrollments in that subject here at Tyndale, you could be forgiven for thinking that it doesn't really matter. After all, the past is over. It never changes, and it certainly won't change the present or the future, so why bother with it? If this is your line of reasoning, then I'm afraid I must try, as tactfully as I can, to correct you. In reality, the past is always changing, as historians and archaeologists continually come up with new discoveries and find fresh ways of interrogating the evidence that has come down to us. The truth is that our factual knowledge of the past has expanded enormously just in the past 50 years. But there's a more important reason why history matters in a Christian liberal arts college. Christianity and Judaism are both historical religions. Their sacred writings purport to tell the world about events that occurred in specific places at specific times, and involving specific named people. They do not present themselves, as do the ancient religions of Mesopotamia, Egypt, India, or Greece, as myths, comforting or scary stories about the activities of various gods and goddesses. No, they present themselves as factual accounts of God's interventions in human affairs and how human beings responded to those interventions. In other words, the authors of these accounts ask us to accept them as truthful and reliable, in the same way that other ancient writers, the historians Herodotus, Thucydides, Xenophon, and Tacitus, present their accounts as truthful. In this connection, I find it fascinating that Jesus declared himself to be the truth. By saying this, he authorized all of us, whatever our subject, to be uncompromising in our pursuit of truth, let the chips fall where they may. That is why, as a professional historian, I regard it as an obligation to scrutinize the evidence that has come down to us of the life of Jesus and see whether it satisfies modern criteria of validity. But why should meeting modern standards of validity matter when it comes to assessing evidence that was generated almost two millennia ago? To understand why it matters, you only have to look at an article that appeared in Maclean's magazine just before Easter under the provocative title, "Did Jesus Really Exist?" It was a shallow, one-sided piece that purported to report on recent so-called scientific findings, casting doubt on whether there was ever a person resembling Jesus, the Jesus we read about in the Gospels and letters of the New Testament. This recent so-called science included the discoveries of psychologists that the human memory is very fallible, and therefore accounts written down decades after the events they purport to describe cannot be trusted. There is also the implication that the New Testament is shot through with wishful thinking, another reason for being suspicious of its account of Jesus' life. These pretended new scientific findings on memory are in fact old hat. Recent research on human memory has documented that while we quickly forget trivial facts, such as what I wore to class 3 weeks ago or what I ate for lunch the Tuesday before last, we're pretty good at remembering events that were unique for us or that had powerful emotional associations. Thus, I remember clearly what I wore on August the 31st, 1963. Why? Because it was my wedding day. I also have a vivid memory of March the 16th, 1970, because on that day I was at the York Finch Hospital witnessing the birth of my first son. Psychologists have also found that memories are more likely to be accurate if they are frequently repeated. Now, think how this applies to the early apostles. In Jesus, they encountered the most vivid, unforgettable person they had ever known. They witnessed his life on earth, his arrest, trial, crucifixion, resurrection, and ascension. These were unique events of tremendous emotional power and significance to them. At once, they began telling others what they had seen and heard. Their accounts were continually repeated and checked against one another until finally, 30 to 70 years later, they were written down. And actually, the first written account of Jesus' resurrection dates not from 30, but approximately 20 years after the event. In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, where he says that 500 people saw the risen Christ and most of them were still alive, meaning you could still go and interrogate them if you wanted to. And that's why the noted international historian Felipe Fernandez Armesto has recently written, "The collections of stories and sayings about Jesus' life, death, and resurrection are unusually reliable by the standards of most such sources for ancient history." It's also why numerous scholars like J.B. Phillips, John Robinson, N.T. Wright, and Richard Baucom have said that the New Testament has the ring of truth. I endorse those judgments. Two of the Gospels, Matthew and John, were composed by eyewitnesses. The other two, by those who knew and interviewed eyewitnesses, Mark and Luke. A striking feature of the Gospels, and one that increases their credibility, is the number of awkward passages. I mean passages that the authors of them probably wished they didn't have to include. For example, the disciples are regularly portrayed as somewhat dense and dim-witted. They just don't get what Jesus is talking about and have to have it painstakingly explained to them. They are sometimes jealous and competitive towards one another. Another awkward thing is the hugely embarrassing fact that one of Jesus' closest followers, Judas Iscariot, accepts a bribe from the Jewish authorities to turn him in at a convenient time when there are no crowds around to defend him. Then there's the episode of the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist. John had been preaching the baptism of repentance. So what need did the perfect Son of God have for repentance? It's also the case that not every town and village Jesus entered welcomed him with open arms. Quite a few places, we read, were impervious or hostile to his message. Even members of his own family rejected what he had to say. And according to Mark, at one point, they said he was mad. And what about the fact that the man supposed to be the Messiah ends up suffering a most disgraceful death, being nailed to a cross? This was certainly not what his followers were anticipating. It was not in their script. And perhaps most shockingly of all, who, we are told, are the first people to come across the empty tomb and to hear the news of the resurrection? Not the male disciples. No, it was the women who went to the tomb early on Sunday morning to care for the dead body of Jesus. To ancient ears, it would have been much more credible if the amazing news that Jesus had risen from the dead was announced first by men. Because back then, it was generally believed that women were emotional, unlike men who were rational. Women talked a lot, but they couldn't be trusted. This is why women were not allowed to testify in court. Anything they reported could never attain the status of legal testimony. So, to say the least, it was awkward to have to admit that women were the ones who first witnessed the resurrection. There are several other awkward passages in the Gospels. Yet when you consider them all together, they reinforce the credibility of those texts. So, to sum up, psychologists now tell us that memory vividness correlates significantly with the emotion and importance of the memories in question and the amount of rehearsal or repetition they receive. An inherent aspect of remembering is the quest for meaning. Most people who are recalling the past intend to recall what really happened, not create fairy tales about what happened. This is made explicit in John's Gospel. His followers, who edited the Gospel, added their own comment at the end, quote, "We know that what he said is true." So we're confronted with two choices. Either we can accept that John's Gospel is a truthful account of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, or we must dismiss John and his followers as charlatans and liars. But then what reason would they have to devote their lives to proclaiming a made-up, fabricated story? Because they thought it would be profitable? That selling this story to gullible people would guarantee them a comfortable living in their old age? Bear in mind that those who composed the stories about Jesus and transmitted them were regularly commanded by the authorities to stop, to recant what they were saying, and to renounce their new faith. The apostles and those who adhered to them refused to be silenced. Their answer to the authorities was, "We cannot deny what we know to be true. How could we? It is the most important truth that has ever been revealed to the world." Far from renouncing their story, many of them willingly submitted to punishment, torture, imprisonment, and death. First was Stephen, to be followed by Peter, James, Bartholomew, Paul, and over the next three centuries, several thousand others. How likely does it seem to you that the actual eyewitnesses or the people who knew the eyewitnesses would have given up their lives on behalf of a story about a person who never existed and which they knew to be false? The numerous martyrdoms of early Christians crucially remind us that theirs was not cheap testimony. It was costly. It was rooted in precise historical events, and the people who witnessed those events were ready to attest to the truth of what they said with their own blood. This reality compels any fair-minded person to ponder seriously what the writers of the New Testament said and whether it doesn't compel our assent. So, because the New Testament is about historical events, not fictions, that is why history does matter, not only to the members of a Christian liberal arts college, but to the whole world. Thank you.